says, leave your gun out, here's honor too. Lean back and stay a while now, here's monitor.
Monitor keeps you up to date. This is your host, Brad Crandall. In this half hour, an eyewitness description of Scotland's legendary Loch Ness Monster. Another of the Loch Ness reports you've been hearing this weekend on Monitor. And 2.5 minutes ahead, a no-nonsense appraisal of American burlesque, its rise and fall. The Tijuana Brass play first, The Happening. The show business, known as burlesque, was an authentic, homegrown phenomenon. It prospered in America, and it declined here. What led to its downfall? What was the main appeal of burlesque? Does it have a future? Well, New York lawyer and businessman Irving Zeidman covers it all in his comprehensive book, The American Burlesque Show. He talked with Monitor reporter Leonard Probst.
Mr. Zeidman, let me ask you this. Your book, which is a comprehensive history of burlesque and a very balanced and scholarly work, opens with the line, "The trouble with American burlesque is that it either has been too dirty or else it hasn't been dirty enough." Is that a one-sentence summation of the history of burlesque?
Yes, I think so. That's been the whole trouble with burlesque. Either it wasn't dirty enough to satisfy the steady customers, or it was too dirty to please the senses. And the burlesque operators had to toe a middle line that was very tortuous for them to follow. And that, in many cases, led to financial disaster.
Well, has burlesque in any way reflected the economic state of America? Does it go up and down, or is it do we get more burlesque in bad times and less burlesque in good times?
Burlesque thrives on depression. The real reason for that, well, there are two reasons. The main reason is that pretty girls are obtainable at the prices that burlesque can afford to pay. Also, the customers are forced to select cheaper forms of entertainment for themselves. During the Depression of the 1930s, for the first time in years, in fact, in decades, there were pretty girls in burlesque, pretty chorus girls, and the whole strip era came about because burlesque operators were able to secure shapely girls in their performances. something which before could be obtainable very, very rarely. Also, a lot of unemployed men had nothing else to do at their time but spend 15 to 25 cents and sit all day in a burlesque theater and pass the time that way.
A burlesque show is essentially composed of girls and comics. Which is the most essential, the comics or the girls?
Audiences go to burlesque shows to see the girls. They do not go to see the comics. I mentioned the Apollo Theater in New York City, which was one of the top burlesque theaters in the 1930s, just before all burlesque was banned. Now, they had the keenest comedians. They had Abbott and Costello. And yet, when the strip was banned, the theater had to close down. People didn't come to burlesque to see Abbott and Costello or any other of the top comedians. And even more recently, I noticed that Harold Minsky had a burlesque theater in Newark, which featured two excellent comics, Irving Benson and Joe DeRita. Irving Benson has now starred in Las Vegas, and he was also featured on television with Milton Berle. Joe DeRita is now one of the Three Stooges, or at least was one of the Three Stooges. And yet, when the strip was banned in Newark, immediately, the theater had to close down.
Is burlesque really a past art now as far as America is concerned? Is it finished?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. Frankly, when up to a few years ago, I was ready to put in my book that burlesque is dead. No sooner had I decided on this brilliant bit of judgment than, lo and behold, a few burlesque theaters opened in New York City. My opinion is that burlesque in the future will be just the way it is now in New York City. There will always be enough of an audience for perhaps two or three theaters, consisting of the main of men who get an unusual kick out of the nudity and the salaciousness that accompanies it, consisting also in the afternoon of a few adolescents, though they have lost most of this audience. The adolescents now don't come to burlesque as they did in the 1920s and 30s. This hardcore that will make up the matinee and the weekday evening performances, supplemented by what I call the Saturday and Friday night giggling slummers, will just about be sufficient to keep maybe two or three burlesque theaters in operation. But beyond that, I don't see much of a hope or a future for them.
Mr. Irving Zeidman, lawyer, businessman, and authority on the American Burlesque Show, giving us some no-nonsense opinions as a result of his investigation into the American art of burlesque. Leonard Probst, NBC News, New York, for Monitor.
Be still. Just look into my eyes and hold my hand.
Until the melody.
it comes through to us.
Number by Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, Be Still. It's 19 minutes after the hour, and here's a question about the fabled Loch Ness Monster. How did it ever get into Loch Ness, a virtually landlocked body of water? An expert gives his theory in 4 minutes. Meanwhile, you're on the monitor beacon.
Jim, are you listening?
Mm-hmm.
Jim, it says here you can turn your knowledge into college credits, like if you're over 40 and want a college degree. Of course, I don't know whether you want one or not. You never tell me anything. Are you listening, Jim?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It says New York State has a college credit by examination program. You don't need classroom training in a subject. You just take an exam in it. Then when you pass, most colleges grant credits. It says Wright State Education Department, Albany. Jim, are you listening?
I don't have to listen. I'm scheduled for the next exam in accounting. Now you listen to me. Why don't you take a freshman English exam?
Jim, there you go again. You never tell me anything. I never know what you're thinking. I think I will take the freshman English exam.
Mm-hmm. Now go over to the desk and write to College Proficiency, State Education Department, Albany, 12224.
The Conversation Station, WNBC, New York. Monitor continues now with music by the Letterman. Here's Volare.
Away from the maddening crowds, we can sing in the glow of a star that I know of, where lovers enjoy peace of mind. Let us leave the confusion and all disillusion behind. Just like birds of a feather, a rainbow together will find.
El volavo, volavo, felice, più in alto del sole, ancora più su, mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me.
My happy heart sings. Your love has given me wings.
Nel dipinto di blu.
No wonder my happy heart sings.
Felice di stare lassù.
Your love has given me wings.
Nel dipinto di blu.
No. At this very moment, on remote Loch Ness in northern Scotland, cameras may be panning across the dark surface of that mysterious body of water. Summer volunteers are keeping patient vigil at Loch Ness in an attempt to capture the legendary Loch Ness Monster on movie film. You've heard the history of the aquatic monster in monitor interviews throughout the weekend. One expert involved in the new Loch Ness photo project is Clem Lister Skelton, resident technician at the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau. Mr. Skelton is one of many who claim to have seen the famous creature in the loch. Reporter Hugh Ross asked him to describe it.
Now, all I can tell you about what it looked like was, I suppose the head could be described as the head of a snake. It had a small head. It got wider as it got towards the body, and then this huge bulbous back behind it. And the neck was lying at an angle of about 30 degrees to the water, and the head was darting about, very quick, jerky motions. Well, that was it. That was my moment of glory, if only it had stayed a little longer and let me take its picture.
Clem, this creature that we've been talking about, I'm going to assume for the moment that there is a creature. How did it get here?
Well, you know, when you get into these questions, one is dealing with hypotheses. The only thing one can be dogmatic about is not to be dogmatic. But this is my own personal belief. I believe that towards the end of the last ice age, these creatures were probably feeding at the heads of glaciers. Now, at this time, Loch Ness was probably filled with ice, and the glacier moved back. And as the glacier moved back, the creatures followed it into what is now Loch Ness. And then the ice cap receded towards the pole, and the landmass, released from the huge crushing weight of ice, rose. And Loch Ness ceased to be an arm of the sea. It was, in fact, cut off from the sea. It became virtually landlocked. Now, this must have happened in many parts of the world, but in a few parts of the world, and this is one of them, they were left with an adequate food supply, and they lived happily ever afterwards.
What do you think they feed on?
Oh, I think their prime food is probably eel. There is an enormous amount of eel, between 1 and 200 feet in this loch. Of course, there's also a very large salmon and trout population on the surface. And there is vegetable debris right down at the bottom.
Well, no, Clem, this creature or monster legend is all over the Highlands of Scotland. It's all over Ireland. It's all over Norway. It's in Iceland. I believe it's also in some of the lakes in Canada. Are there investigations taking place in any other areas in Scotland?
Not to my knowledge. I think what you've got to realize is that this is the famous one, that financing an expedition of this nature takes a great deal of capital, and that people and capital are only going to be attracted to something as famous as the beast of Loch Ness.
Clem, there's a story that the temperature of Loch Ness is such that it can't be swum.
Well, this is completely untrue because it was swum last year.
Yes, but I wouldn't accept the fact that it was swum in the normal course of events. It was swum in a way, but people just don't swim in Loch Ness, and you don't see much boating on Loch Ness. Is there something about the loch which prevents that sort of thing?
Well, you try and persuade one of the local chaps to take his salmon dinghy out at night, and he'll probably spit at you. Why? I'm sure it is. Why else shouldn't he go fishing at night?
I've been out on the loch here at night, and no question about it.
I've been out here on the loch at night, and you do occasionally see a boat out on the loch at night.
Clem Lister Skelton, resident technician at the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau in Scotland.
Thank you.
Reuben Mitchell at the piano with Lady Godiva. You're with Monitor, keeping you up to date as it covers the weekend world. In the Quad City area of the broad Midwest, we're reaching you on WOC Radio, Davenport, Iowa. This is Brad Crandall.
You're with the Now program for all seasons, Monitor, on the NBC Radio Network.
This is Monitor. I'm Brad Crandall, and during this half hour, you'll meet one of the nation's brightest young science students. At the National Youth Science Camp, boys like him from every state share ambitions and ideas. 2.5 minutes from now, outfielder Carl Yastrzemski of the Boston Red Sox talks over off-season conditioning with Joe Garagiola. But first, the 4-day Black Power Conference ended tonight in riot-torn Newark, New Jersey. Its purpose, to achieve unity among advocates of black power in the United States. NBC News reporter Clem Tucker, who covered the conference, files his follow-up report.
A short while ago, the Black Power Conference ended after 4 stormy days in Newark. The militants clearly seized control of it. We spoke with Dr. Nathan Wright, a leading advocate of black power, and asked him his impressions of the conference.
I think that the event is significant in that it was the most representative segment representative gathering of different segments of in the black community in the history of this nation. What black people need most for their own good and for the larger good of this nation as a whole and our world is unity, to work together for empowerment, for self-directed efforts at self-sufficiency and self-respect.
Do you think that this was achieved as the 4-day conference ends?
Well, I think that their coming together was achieved on the very first day of the conference. And so I was pleased on the very first day of the conference and felt that the conference was a success at that time.
Then we went on and asked Dr. Wright about the militant tone of the conference because of the fact that many of the resolutions coming out, if not all of them, coming out of the conference, had a definite stormy tone, some even somewhat rebellious, one calling for the creation of a separate black state. Dr. Wright made these comments.
My chief concern was that the conference be set up so that people could have the opportunity of sharing in creative dialogue. We can never guarantee what results may be.
And of course, finally, we wondered about the future of the movement. Does it stand a chance? Where does Dr. Wright think it is going from here?
Well, it's difficult to say where the movement may go, but I think that just the whole business of opening up the issue of the empowerment of human life for fulfillment is a tremendous service to our nation and world. Most of the things that we do in terms of the public good are designed to bring relief to human life and not necessarily to give life power to become what the agency of its creation designed for it to be.
Of course, whether the Black Power movement is a force for good, either in the black community or the world, as its advocates say it will be, or whether it is a force for bad, remains to be seen. This is Lem Tucker, NBC News, New York.
To keep up with the world around you, stay with Monitor. Now here's Joe Garagiola with Monitor Sports. Joe went to Boston's Fenway Park to get the lowdown on keeping fit from one of the nation's leading baseball players.
Carl Yastrzemski of the Boston Red Sox is an established star in the American League, and he's having a great year for him. But Carl knows that a ball player can't rest on his laurels. This past winter, Carl concentrated on keeping in top condition, and recently he explained to me why he did it and how.
This is the first time, actually, that I worked out in the offseason. I'd been continuing my education in college and had not had the opportunity. And therefore, last year and even the year before, I felt myself in July and August not becoming strong, not getting a second wind. Whereas when I was on the farm in Long Island when I first broke into pro ball, August, and September were my great months. I seemed to get that second win and bounce back. And then I said, well, it might be due because I had not worked out. I'd been going to college, and therefore my muscles were becoming lax and a little more weakened.
And you paid the price and worked out, so you would get that second win.
Yes, and by working out, I worked out under supervision. I worked out for an hour and 40 minutes every day, straight through, and someone was leading me in calisthenics, so I was qualified for it. In fact, it was Jane Beard, who was a Hungarian refugee and who trained the European soccer teams for so many years in Olympics.
What were some of the special exercises that a baseball player like you of your stature were doing?
Number one, I did not use any weights at all. Weights are bad for you. Number two, it would be exercises to improve my coordination and to make my muscles more elastic and longer, not bulgy. Number three, I did a lot of exercises a boxer would do. For instance, I skipped rope for 5 minutes periods after 20 minutes of workout. My breather would be to skip rope for 5 minutes. I'd punch the bag, the speed bag, to quicken my hands and things like this. But there again, I stayed away from weights whatsoever.
One final question. This ballpark is easy for a right-hand hitter, supposedly because of the left field fence. You're a left-handed batter. Do you adjust according to a pitcher and try to use that left field fence, or do you just head straight away here and the same in Yankee Stadium?
This year has been a little bit different. I've been pulling the ball all the time, but I know that wall is out there, and I know if I'm in a bad batting slump or something of that nature, that wall can be reached just by flicking my wrist. It's a thing which, say, it's a good mental thing. You know it's there, and if you want to use it, I'm capable of doing it. But this year, I'm not using it as much as last year or year before.
Well, if you're so confident of flicking your wrist, why wouldn't you use it, or do you feel that you'd be out of the groove when you went on the road?
I think it's hurt me in that respect, Joe. When I'm going on the road, sometimes you're a little late on balls, and in a bigger field, say like Yankee Stadium, those drives at the left center, left field, are outs, which would be off the wall here in Fenway Park. So this year I thought of hitting one way all the way.
Carl, thank you very, very much for taking so much time. I appreciate it. I know the fans enjoyed listening to you.
Thank you, Joe. It's always a pleasure.
That was Boston Red Sox outfielder Carl Yastrzemski. And this is Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports.
It's 18 minutes before the hour. This is your news and information center. Wherever you are in the USA, you're on the Monitor Beacon.
You've probably heard Hugh Downs on Monitor Radio tell you about a special summer hearing aid value. Right now, Zenith is introducing a new tiny hearing aid, the Carlyle. It's the smallest, slimmest eyeglass hearing aid Zenith has ever made. So slender, it's hard to believe there's a quality Zenith hearing aid in the Temple Bar. And you can probably use your present eyeglass frame fronts. So let Alban Standard Surgical, 3827 Bell Boulevard, Bayside, Queens, show you how inconspicuous a hearing aid can be. But do it now, because for a limited time only, they're offering a special introductory price on this tiny new Carlyle. And while you're there, see any of the other 18 Zenith Living Sound hearing aids. Now's the time to visit Alban Standard Surgical, 3827 Bell Boulevard, Bayside, Queens. While the sounds of summer are on sale, you'll be glad you did. The Conversation Station, WNBC, New York.
Question, please. How does a superior teenage science student spend part of his summer? At the National Youth Science Camp, if he's bright enough to be chosen, meet one of the 100 boys picked this year, just 3 minutes from now. Monitor music by Connie Francis. My heart cries for you.
Thank you.
From every state, the finest science students to be found are chosen each summer to attend West Virginia's National Youth Science Camp. It's a mighty select group of 100. These young men are not only bright, they can be articulate and modest, too. Meet Mark Levitt from the Southwest, who talked with Monitor's Peter Hackus.
Mark, first tell our Monitor listeners, if you will, a little bit about yourself and your science interest.
I'm 17 years old right now, and I graduated last June from Tucson High School. I've been interested in electronics since I was 10 years old and have pretty well pursued this course of study, electronics and associated fields, and that is my science interest.
And what have you been doing this summer?
Well, this summer I've been attending the National Youth Science Camp. It started June 23rd, and I've been there since then.
And what have you done? What's been your experience there?
Well, there have been a lot of experiences. We've been exposed to all areas of science. We've had lectures from visiting scientists, even lectures from visiting English professors. It's been very varied. We've had field trips to many points of interest, not only scientifically, but of general interest, such as caves and mountain hikes and such things.
Well, now, what about your hobbies as a scientifically oriented person?
Well, I have been an amateur radio operator since I was 10. This is what got me started in electronics. And I have sort of branched out. I'm interested in all types of electronics now, not only radio, but hi-fi. I'm a hi-fi enthusiast. I like to keep everybody awake at night listening to the hi-fi. And, of course, in areas other than science, I'm interested in playing the accordion. I play the accordion and like working on cars, several things.
Well, it ought to keep you busy. Where are you headed in the fall now that you're out of high school?
Well, I'll be going to the University of Arizona, right there in Tucson.
And eventually, what do you hope to be doing, Mark?
Well, I'd like to become an electronics research and development engineer.
Well, then, as much as there are only 100 boys chosen for the National Youth Science Camp each year, I suppose it's not really too easy to get there.
Well, the governor chooses two from each state, and these are selected from a candidate nominated from each school. So I guess they just go over the general qualifications and what science projects you've done in the past.
I think you're being very modest, actually.
Thank you.
Well, I suppose all of this science concentration keeps you pretty much nailed to your books, doesn't it?
No, I don't like to think so. I enjoy a lot of other things. I find that science makes it easier for me to enjoy things other than science, makes me appreciate them more.
Your interest in electronics, has it posed any problems with the family or the neighbors?
Well, they've been very tolerant. I suppose it has posed some problems. There was one occasion when I put up a 40-foot-high antenna that fell in the neighbor's yard. And
40-foot-high antenna. That's four stories high. Tremendous.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And what? How did it fall over?
Well, a big wind came up, and one of the guy wires let go, and it fell.
And they were very understanding.
Well, yes, they let me put up another one. I put up another one in a few months, so...
Have you forced any of the family out of any particular rooms and sort of taken over part of the house?
Well, amateur radio tends to do that sometimes. Some people don't like to sleep to Morse code. And sometimes the best DX, which is distance reception, comes in late at night. So it's either amateur radio or sleep sometimes.
Well, very good. We certainly wish you well, Mark Levitt of Tucson, Arizona. And we trust that the rest of your summer will be cool and most enjoyable in West Virginia.
Thank you.
2 days ago, the world lost a fine actor who was a fine human being as well. You may identify him with Sherlock Holmes or with the stuffy patrician types he often portrayed. This was not the real Basil Rathbone. He was a member of Monitor's family for more than a year with his In and Out of Character series, on which he read verse, drama, and even popular song lyrics. The real Basil Rathbone was warm-hearted, not stuffy. Considerate, not withdrawn. So energetic, vital, that he could almost wear you out with his enthusiasm. We will remember that about him.